For that reminder, Genesis 10 and 11. Genesis 10 and 11 are where we are, as Rob mentioned last week. I'll be covering these chapters. If you happen to read ahead, Genesis 10 and 11, you notice that in these two chapters there are two genealogies. And maybe you wondered, did Rob just stick Josh with all those ancient Hebrew names to pronounce? I don't think it was intentional. And no, we're not going to have some sort of reading contest this morning to see if I can pronounce all of them. I'm not going to read a genealogy to you either. You can just kind of, everyone can exhale. Can we get a collective exhale? We're not going to read all of these ancient Hebrew names. But we are seeking to take these two chapters and start to conclude the book of Genesis as we move into the holiday season. And so we'll look at two chapters this morning. And as we do that, I'm actually ironically reminded that during the Thanksgiving weekend, when I watched lots of football, that's my guilty pleasure. Is it a guilty pleasure, Baron?
No, sir.
No, sir. All right, I'm going to take his word for it. As I watched a lot of football on Thanksgiving weekend, far too many times I saw Kelly Ripa on my TV screen, which would be for any reason whatsoever. But in this case, Kelly Ripa was trying to get me, and I guess lots of other guys who watch football, to go to Ancestry.com, and for $49.99, you can take a DNA test, and you can find out what you really are. And I saw this commercial again and again and again. I did not go to Ancestry.com and take the test, for those who are curious. The marketing didn't work. But it got me to thinking, as I was looking at Genesis 10 and 11, that genealogies and ancestry are not something just new. It's actually something that's very old, and we've really always been interested in it. Now, we as Americans are not so huge on our ancestry in terms of are we nobility or not, and we're not trying to prove that we have some certain place in society, but we as Americans are very, very intrigued to find out how we fit into this melting pot. Let me give you a few different facts which might be of interest to you about Ancestry.com. It has 20 billion records about family trees. 20 billion records have been added over the last two decades, and it adds 2 million new records each day based upon the growth in the last 5 years. Ancestry.com has 100 million family trees containing more than 11 billion ancestral profiles. And they've uploaded and attached more than 330 million photographs, scan documents, and written stories. They are in over 80 countries worldwide, and they can access records dating back to the 1200s. That's a long time ago. And people will pay $50 to find out exactly what they are. There have been a variety of taglines that Ancestry.com has used to create interest, and they all resonate with us. Learn how Ancestry DNA helps answer, who am I? Isn't that what we want to know? Who am I? As our customers look into their ethnic origins, Ancestry.com says, and connect with genetic relatives, they see themselves in a new way. Maybe some of you have been on Ancestry.com. Maybe you're part of those 100 million family trees. Maybe you're part of the 20 billion records. Maybe you experientially know what I'm talking about, whereas I'm just observing. Ancestry is helping people discover with greater detail the stories of those who came before them. You see, as you look at these facts and the dates and the names and the grandfathers and the cousins once and twice removed, it's not just simply names on a chart, but all of those people have a story, and we find our story in their story. And this is what Ancestry.com has tapped into. 20 million members, one of their taglines says, 20 million members connected to a deeper family story. I'd love to read some of the stories to you. We don't have time this morning, but one of the individuals who went to Ancestry.com, had the DNA test, was surprised to find out that she was Native American. It was not a part of the story that she'd ever known. And she said, "This is what I'm made of. This is where my ancestors came from. It's opened up a whole new world to me." For many people, wittingly or unwittingly, as they look at their heritage, their family tree, they are unlocking their past to inspire their future. Now, whether or not you think that's all just a bunch of marketing gobbledygook or not, for many people, it resonates. They want to go. Some will even go to the land of their heritage, and it helps them to understand kind of why they tick the way they do. Are they kind of carefree and things just kind of happen and they roll with it, or are they kind of regimented and in order? In fact, linguists tell us that the languages of the various people groups around the world are not simply their way of communicating the very same things in a different way, but the language patterns around the world are a window into how we operate. American English is very direct and to the point. So much so that in some cultures it's assumed to be rude because you don't beat around the bush, you just go straight through. Other cultures' languages are far less direct and they're more, we would say, passive. They go around the topic to get you to the conclusion. Because it's not just the way they communicate, it's the way they are. And so as we look at chapters 10 and 11 this morning, I think that we have the opportunity to see that God is moving us through not simply a list of names that would make a great phonics exercise, but He's moving us through a part of the story that actually sticks us somewhere in the story. And I hope you'll find that this morning. If you can just glance through chapters 10 and 11, I want to give you a quick overview of where we're going this morning. When we look at chapter 10, we're looking at the origin of nations. Chapter 10 gives us the origin of nations. It's the generations of the sons of Noah. We go to chapter 11, the passage that we read a little bit ago, and it's the origin of languages. And then we get to the end of that story, and we go back to some genealogies, and we'll kind of notice this later, but we get to the origin of Abraham in chapter 11 and verse 10. And we're going to look at all of this because we want to search for significance this morning. We want to search for significance. You see, that's what people do when they go and look at their genealogy. They want to see if there's someone significant in their past. Are they related to George Washington? Are they related to Louis XIV? Is there some Russian princess in their past? Is there significance? Is there something they can latch on to? And this set of two chapters, I hope, will show us that there is significance that we should search for, but we've got to search in the right place. Let's start with the origin of nations in chapter 10. The origin of nations is found in verses 1 through 32, and it is God blessing the world. Let's just go back quickly to chapter 9 and verse 1. It says, God blessed Noah and his sons. He said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Go to chapter 9 and verse 7. He says, and you be fruitful and multiply, teem on the earth and multiply in it. God is wanting to bless this group of 8 people who come off of the ark. 8 people, a whole new world. It's fresh, it's green, it's got that scent of spring. New grass, new trees, new flowers just starting to bud. And what does God do? God blesses. And if we look at chapter 10 as a whole, we see generation upon generation. We see people group after people group. We see where all these people come from, and we are reminded that the proliferation of life is the blessing of God. I'm going to just use a graphic. I told you I wasn't going to read all the names. That looks really small on the screen. Can you read that? All right, so there's neither can I. I forgot my pointer, so I'm going to use my finger. Does that help? Yeah, right? If I could shoot lasers out of my finger. You've got Noah at the top there. And then you've got his 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And basically, this is in pictorial form what Genesis 10 is. And this is why I'm not going to read it, because I found a picture. And a picture is worth 1,000 words, right? Pictures worth a thousand words. So here are Noah's three sons, and here are those three sons' children and grandchildren for Japheth on the far right. In the middle, you have Ham. You've got his children, his grandchildren, and two of his great-grandchildren. And then Shem on the left, you've got his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, one of them, one great-grandchild, two of his great-great-grandchildren, and then a bunch of his great-great-great-grandchildren. Genesis 10 goes from right to left. It goes with the family history of Japheth first. Then it goes to the family history of Ham second, and it goes to the family history of Shem last. Ironically, Shem is the oldest, and he's talked about last. As you look at that table, I want you to look back at the end of chapter 9. Rob looked at these verses a little bit last week, and I want to go back to them just for a moment. Genesis 9, verses 26 and 27. Noah said to his sons, either right after the incident where Shem and Japheth covered him up when he was drunk, or at some time thereafter, Noah said to his sons, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." What we're reading in Genesis 10 is not an isolated, oh, let's just stick a genealogy in there. It really comes on the heels of what Noah said. And if we can go back to that graphic real quick, it said, "Blessed be the God of Shem." You see a big focus on Shem. And it said, let God enlarge Japheth. And it's ironic that in the genealogy, Japheth has the least. Does that mean that God didn't bless Japheth? Or Noah's looking at this and Noah's saying, you know, Japheth is going to be small. May God enlarge him. May God give him more. You and I look at this chart and we think, okay, so Noah saw his children, he probably saw his grandchildren, but that's about it. But we've got to remember that the end of Genesis 9 tells us that Noah lived for 350 years after the flood. So Noah saw down through these generations. Noah lived and saw not just his grandchildren and not just his great-grandchildren, but he saw generation after generation after generation. And so as we look at Japheth and we see his family that's a touch smaller, we maybe get a greater sense of how Noah wants God to enlarge that and bless that. Because Japheth had an honor your father sort of mentality. And Noah wanted God to bless that. Shem is part of that Shem and Japheth covering Noah. And Noah says, "Blessed be the God of Shem." Shem is someone who is following the Lord, and we're going to see that as things work further through here. But I want you to look at Ham. Ham's got a lot of real estate up there. May not be able to see all the lines, but really he's got a bunch of the names. And over on the right of Ham, you've got Canaan. You drop down Canaan, he's got all these people groups under him. We need to remember as we look at this genealogy that this genealogy was given to the Hebrews as they're wandering around in the desert. They're slaves and they're trying to find their identity, and they're slaves and they're promised a land to go settle in, and they're slaves who are wandering around in a wilderness and they've got no home of their own, and God told their father Abraham 400 years before that they were going to have the Canaanites' land. And as we look at this genealogy and as they hear this genealogy read to them in the desert, they recognize that Canaan's family in verses 15 to 20 are a cursed family. A cursed family because they followed their own way, because they were idolatrous, because they had purposely rejected God, and in that sliver of what we now call Israel, they had set up many, many hills of worship, and they were opposed to God. We find that their great-great-grandfather, Ham's actions had not determined their destiny, but his actions had influenced their destiny. Ham, who mocked his drunken father Noah's stupor. And so the Hebrews are really finding their place in God's larger story. They're finding their place hundreds of years later in that God said, you're going to conquer them. That Canaan was going to be their servant. And God had promised them through Abraham all of this land. And so as they're in the wilderness and they send spies into the land, and they say the Canaanites are too much for us. They're giants, and we cannot conquer them. Not only are they ignoring the promise to Abraham later in Genesis, but they're ignoring the promise and the blessing that Noah pronounced here, that the God of Shem would make Canaan Shem's servant. This genealogy was meant to show to them that God was going to keep His promise. There's so much in these chapters that we could get bogged down in. I don't want to do that. But I want to point out a story in here, a story that starts in chapter 10 and verse 9. 10 and verse 8 says, Cush, who's one of the sons of Ham, Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first man on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ur, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, and that is the great city. In the middle of this genealogy is a story, as there could be many stories, but this one is inspired and written for us. And it's the story of a kingdom maker named Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. We could even translate it, a mighty hunter against the Lord or in the face of the Lord. He's a city builder, and that's not a problem necessarily, except that the first city he builds is Babel, and we've already read about Babel. And when Babel didn't succeed, what does it say? He went on to build Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and other cities. God took care of the first city, and he didn't get the hint, and he went on, and he kept trying to build other kingdoms of his own. The irony is that the kingdoms he built later on in the Bible turn out to be places that are in great opposition to God, and they're great centers of idol worship, and they're great centers of empire building. And just like all the others, Nimrod dies. I'm reminded of these words from Carl Sagan. He says that the earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Sagan says, think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors like Nimrod. Think of all the blood spilled so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. What does Nimrod do? He builds pinpricks on a gigantic planet that swirls and floats in an amazing galaxy that's neighbored by millions of other galaxies. And Nimrod is seeking to make a name for himself. Among all these peoples, he appears to be great, but he is so small. We learn that these peoples spread apart. We get the origin of the nations, and so those who study archaeology and history have given us a map that gives us at least our best estimation of where all these people spread out. You notice as you look at the map that Ham's descendants are in the green, and they're in Egypt, and they're in Canaan, modern Israel, and some of them are down in the Arabian Peninsula. Those of Japheth are a little harder to see. They're in the red ovals. And they are all the way over, we think, in Italy and in Spain. They're in the Mediterranean coast and in the coast of the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea up there. And then the descendants of Shem, who Shem himself worshipped God, and it appears that some of his descendants did. They're more in that Mesopotamia, and they're in the blue, and that's hard to see in a picture that far away. It'd been helpful if they put that in squares. But they're in that Mesopotamia area, up into a little bit of Asia Minor. We get an idea where the nations come from. We want to know our world. We want to know our place in that world. As we come to the end of chapter 10, we see that there is these lines in verse 32. These are the clans of the sons of Noah according to the genealogy of their nations. And from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. It's a big world and population is growing exponentially. And there is a search for significance. There's a search for significance. And we still find that search for significance today. Among all the families of the earth, we're still trying to figure out how we fit in. In this search for significance, I find it interesting that just 2 weeks ago, the Pew Forum released a survey of what gives meaning to life. People are still searching for significance. What gives meaning to life? The single highest rated factor when it was made an open-ended question is that family gives significance and meaning to life. Family. We don't live in clans like these sons of Ham, Shem, and Japheth did. We don't live in tribes. But we still cling to family, don't we? We still remember that blood runs thicker than water. We know that family unites us, and we know as well that family sometimes will divide businesses. Family can divide corporations. Family can divide media empires. Family can divide nations. Family can divide churches. And families can even divide families. But we're still wanting to be attached to family. And it reminds us that Jesus talked about families when he came. He talked about those who could call the God of heaven their heavenly Father, and they could be part of a heavenly family. In fact, the book of John says that to those who received him, he gave the power to become the children of God, to be part of the family of God. And yet Jesus also drew this incredibly, to us, harsh distinction. That there are those who are actually part of another family, and their father is the father of lies, and they are, Jesus said, children of the devil. Paul said they're children of darkness. Paul warned about those who were children of darkness, and he called those who were believers to walk as children of light. You could not have two more distinct groups, children of darkness, children of light, children who have the devil as their father, and children who have the God, the one true God, the Creator, as their Father. And every single person in this room is obviously not only a member of an earthly family, but every single person in this room is the member of a spiritual family. Either the family, the Father of lights, or the family, the Father of darkness and of lies. Which family are you in? Because it's really significant. What's your ancestry? Realize it's a sobering question for what's supposed to be a festive holiday season, but really the reason that this season is so festive is because we have the opportunity to move from the default family of darkness into the family of light. It's very possible that there are those here, adults and young people, who are not children of light. As we study this genealogy, your ancestry is going to determine your destiny. Will you be a child of the light? Will you, as John 1:12 says, receive him? But to those who received him, To those he gave the authority to be children of God, even to those who believe, even to those who trust in his name. Are you trusting in the name of Jesus? Our songs have given us the gospel message this morning that Jesus came, born, gloriously sang about by angels, living in obscurity, dying on a cross, not as a martyr, but in place of us as sinners, rising from the grave to give us life. Will you believe he died for you? Will you move from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light? Will you answer the invitation of the Heavenly Father to be his child? If you have questions about that, I'm more than happy to talk with you about that. Anyone who sang up here this morning, we'd be happy to talk with you about that. We are here to call people out of darkness into the light. And the ancestry of each one of you, the spiritual ancestry, has great spiritual significance. We move to the origin of languages, which is an explanation for why we talk the way we do, but it is more than that. We've already read it. And one thing we want to note as we look at this section in 11:1 through 9 is that we're actually moving a little backwards in the narrative. Genesis does this, doesn't it? Genesis chapter 1 comes to the seventh day, and Genesis 2 goes back and talks about what happened on the sixth day. We're used to this, though, in movies. We've got a movie that gives us this event, and then it goes backward to explain some of the stuff that was in that first scene. And so that's what happens here in Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11 tells us, actually we can find the location for Hebrews 11 in Genesis 11. I don't know why I keep saying Hebrews. We can find the time frame for Genesis 11 up in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 25. Look at Genesis 10:25. To Eber, who is one of the family of Shem, to Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. Many Bible scholars believe that that phrase is referring to what happens in Genesis chapter 11. There's a division. And if you go later in Genesis 11, you find out how long Peleg lived, and so we can approximate when the Tower of Babel incident occurred. It probably occurred between 100 and 340 years after the flood. Between 100 and 340 years after the flood, the Tower of Babel takes place. Now, if you remember, Noah lived 350 years after the flood took place. So the Tower of Babel, if you take these numbers in Genesis 11 to be not just accurate but literal, which I do, and I don't think there's any reason not to. The story of the Tower of Babel takes place while Noah is still alive. Noah and his three sons are eyewitnesses to God destroying the world for its rebellion. And what happens during their lifetime? Oops, humanity does it again. People who, just like in Noah's day, had Adam living and they found out, could have, in many cases did, know what life was like before sin, and they still perpetuate their wickedness. Here we almost have Genesis 6 in the pre-flood era repeated for us. People who could have and did hear from Noah and Shem, Ham, and Japheth what it was like before the flood, and then the flood, and then after the flood, still think that they can oppose God. See, the Tower of Babel is not just some sort of ancient building project that got messed up. It is an expression of rebellion and opposition. How do we know this? Because the people who build the city and the tower in Babel tell us why they're doing it. Look at verses 4 and following. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves." lest we be dispersed over the face of all the earth. They figure out a way to make quality bricks. They figure out a way to make a quality mortar because they want a city that's going to last, to make a name for themselves. And they don't want to be dispersed over the face of the earth. And they do this in defiant opposition to God. You and I just look at it as a building project. It's just people doing what people do. It's people doing what people do without God in their minds, in their hearts, without God in their ambitions. What a cautionary tale for us. We're just going about life. We've got a job. We've got a house. We want to make a nice yard. We want to make the house look good for Christmas. And none of these things are wrong. City building was not wrong. It was the purpose in this city building. Babel, it says in chapter 10, was founded by Nimrod. Nimrod to us sounds like such a, well, you look it up in the dictionary and it's a nickname for someone who's an idiot. But Nimrod was by no means an idiot. Nimrod founded a half dozen cities. Nimrod was a great man in the eyes of a godless society. He was an organizer. Let's build a place to make a name for ourselves. How successful was that? How successful was it? The Bible uses what we call anthropomorphic language. It gives God human characteristics. And it says that this great city that they were attempting to build, God had to come down and look at. Makes me think of a little kid who wants their parent to see the great bug that they found. And what do parents do? Their eyesight's failing, so they get down and they look to see this little bug, because what's so amazing and big to the kids is so small to the adults. God looks down at the city in the Tower of Babel, and he's like, I got to get a closer look. It's so small. Our kingdoms are so small when we build them for ourselves. Some say it looked like a ziggurat. Ziggurat is an ancient Babylonian form of tower. These were meant to be places of worship. So the tower they were building had religious significance. These sorts of towers are found actually in archaeological ruins all around the world. Mexico, Peru, the Far East, obviously Babylon, Mesopotamia. This ziggurat was the best that they could do, and it is a marvel of human achievement. There's no doubt about that. But when our kingdoms, when our projects are about making a name for ourselves and avoiding obeying God's commandment to disperse, when we go against God, we will be frustrated, just as these people and these builders were frustrated. And so God comes down and he punishes them. Punishes them. Not with a worldwide flood, because he's promised never to do that. No, he makes them do what he commanded them to do by giving them different languages, and they can obviously no longer cooperate. And so they move along and they move around to the places we looked at in the map earlier. They move on. And they find that their quest for significance cannot be found in their buildings. Their quest for significance must be somewhere else. This reality, this event of changing the languages, yes, gives us some historical background and an understanding of our world, but it further gives us, I hope, a yearning for something that's different. I hope it gives us this yearning for coming together, not to make a name for ourselves, but coming together to make a name for God. And if you think about the event of Pentecost, what is starting to happen in Pentecost? What is starting to happen in Pentecost is that the people hear about the kingdom of God in their own language. It's really the mirror opposite of what happened at Pentecost. There, people were scattered abroad because of different languages. At Pentecost, people in their own language hear the gospel so that they can come together around God's kingdom. Isn't there a beauty in what God does? And right now we live in this already not yet period where really people are still coming together in different languages and in different tribes and in different tongues, and they're coming together on this day in places all around the world in a variety of time zones, not for themselves, but for God and His kingdom. We're in this in-between phase, and one day the book of Revelation tells us in chapter 21 that the glory of the nations will come in to the New Jerusalem. In Revelation 5, it tells us that there are people even right now from every tribe and tongue and nation, and they are singing with one voice, "Worthy is the Lamb." Babel is a cautionary tale, but Babel is also just a part of human yearning to be together for worship. And it will happen. But not in a temporary thing that we build, but in some city that God brings down, the New Jerusalem. The New Jerusalem. Where the nations will come and they will forever worship the Lamb. The vision of the new heaven and the new earth and the New Jerusalem in Revelation 21 and 22 is not really the vision of just an eternal worship service. It's the vision of Eden perfected forever, and people doing and building and subduing and advancing, not for themselves, but for the one true King. Not led by Nimrod, who is really an antichrist, but by Jesus, who is the Christ. And so what are you looking for this morning? Are you like Abraham? Are you looking for a city that has foundations whose builder and maker is God? Are you looking first for God's kingdom and His righteousness? How is God sanctifying you, believer? Are you less and less concerned about your dreams and your plans, trusting Him more for the day to day, less afraid about what the future may bring, less afraid of what may happen to America? Because what happens to America may be exactly what happens to Rome, what happened to Rome, what happened to Egypt, what happened to Babylon, what happened to the British Empire, what happened to the Third Reich, what is happening to communism. What is happening to all those is that they collapse under the weight of their own ungodliness. And what will stand? The kingdom of our God and of His Christ will stand forever. So no, I don't want to work for a one world government, but I'm not afraid of it. Because the best one world government will come one day in the millennium. And then imagine this, an even better one world government than the best one world government will come, and it will last forever. So we don't need to be afraid. Because the church has survived through all those kingdoms and through all those oppositions. In fact, the church has not just survived in all those, the church has thrived because of the opposition of one world governments and aspiring one world governments. Why else would the gospel grow in China over the last few decades, even when communism holds sway? Because the church is not built by man, the church is built by Jesus. And He's a better builder than Nimrod. He's a better builder than you and I. And if we just fall in line with Him, we have no reason to fear what man can do to us. What did Martin Luther say so well? "Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. The body they may kill, His truth abideth still. His kingdom is forever." Nimrod's kingdom fell. America's kingdom may fall. The gospel went on without America for hundreds of years. The gospel will go on throughout. I'll pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, but I will fall under the banner of the cross every single time, even further. We have no need to fear, for kingdoms will topple, and His kingdom shall stand. He's building a kingdom in the midst of all these others. And so we come to the end of Genesis 11, verses 10 through 28. It is the origin of Abraham because it starts with Shem and it ends in verse 26 with Terah, who had lived 70 years and he fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. This is the origin of Abraham, and this is telling us that someone is coming. Someone is coming. These genealogies in the book of Genesis are not simple, random listings of people to make us feel good. They're not just meant to give us a place in society. But as we come to the New Testament, we come to the account of Jesus in both Matthew and Luke, we see that those accounts start with a genealogy. Why? Why do they start with the genealogy? Go to Genesis 3:15. Genesis 3:15 seems like such a small and simple verse in the hundreds and thousands of verses in our Bible. But Genesis 3:15 is really such a controlling verse. Genesis 3:15, God is cursing the serpent and he says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel." No, we don't have the whole story of Jesus in this verse. All that we have is this general yet clear hope that the serpent will not prevail. We have the clear hope that someone is coming who will be the offspring of Eve, and that someone will be wounded by the serpent, but he will crush the serpent's head. Someone is coming to avenge Adam and Eve. Someone is coming to take vengeance upon the serpent. Someone is coming, and these genealogies that go all the way back in Genesis to Adam, these genealogies prove that God is keeping his promise, and there is always a son of Eve on the horizon. Look at this graphic that helps to put this in perspective. Up at the top, you have Adam, Cain, Abel, Seth. Genesis chapter 5 gives us the genealogy not of Cain, but it gives us the genealogy of Seth. Noah is in the line of Seth. Genesis 11 gives us the genealogy of Shem, because Shem is the great, 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 etc., grandfather of Abraham. And as we look at the genealogies in Matthew and Luke, Jesus is the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham, that through Abraham, all the nations of the earth were going to be blessed. And so Abraham goes back to Shem, who goes back to Seth. And it's not coincidental that it is Shem. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. Shem was a God worshiper. He was not a God worshiper because he grew up in a perfect environment and had Noah as his father. Ham had the same stuff, and it looks like Ham rejected God. Why, we don't know. But God is the God of Shem. Shem brings us Abraham. Abraham brings us Isaac, who brings us Jacob, who brings us Judah, who brings us David, who brings us Jesus. No, you don't find Jesus in Genesis 11, but what you find is that the promise that someone is coming is being kept. And we're getting a better ability to narrow down where the son of Eve is coming from. He's not coming from Cain. He's coming from Seth. He's not coming from Ham or Japheth. He's coming from Shem. He's not coming from Haran or Terah or Nahor. He's coming from Abraham. He's coming. And if you're wandering around in the desert and you're getting Genesis 1, 2, 3, you're getting it written down for the very first time as God inspires it and gives it to Moses, you're wondering, when is this all going to end, because you just came out of Egypt and idolatry was strong. You're wandering around in the wilderness and you're looking at Canaan and you know their idolatry is great. You've got a tabernacle and you've got God and a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day, and you're wondering, how is this all going to work out? And you're reminded that generation after generation after generation, there's significance in all those people, because as the generations follow through, the son of Eve, the someone promised that would come from Eve is in fact coming. The significance is that if we would look for him, we would find him. If we would wait for him, he would come. You and I have we've got this advantage. Our advantage is that he's already come, and we're looking back, and he's promised to come, and we get to look forward. They just had the promise that he was going to come. How much more opportunity do we have to look forward to his coming? In a sense, the celebration of Christmas is not just a celebration that he has come, it's a celebration that he will come. I wonder if you'll use this Christmas season to increase your own yearning for that someone who will come and who'll crush the serpent's head. Will you use these upcoming weeks for more than parties and presents and memories and scrapbooks? Will you use it to feed an appetite for a greater kingdom and a greater king? Will you use it, my friends, my brothers, my sisters, to long for someone to crush the serpent's influence in your heart and the serpent's influence in our society? Will you yearn for something not that might come true, but yearn for something that will come true, that will bring this world a greater significance than it has ever known? Let's stand as the musicians come, and we will sing in preparation to observe the Lord's Supper. We'll sing in preparation. We'll also sing as the elements are passed. If you would prefer not to sing as the elements are passed and simply bow in prayer, that's fine. But we will sing of the coming of this Jesus, the coming the first time. And we will, as we take these elements, show the Lord's death until he comes a second time.